37.
Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. On this program, we're going to expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, as well as with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to try to explain why these things are happening and what it means, not only for your future, but also how it will influence the future of those you love. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms. We're going to explore His Torah teaching. If you are rational, this will be the best part of today's program. If you are religious, it will be the most irritating. Our phone number, should you want to question, criticize, affirm, or just engage in conversation, is 877-376-45. I'd like to offer a mea culpa for the first hour yesterday. I'm sure many of you know that it was recorded as opposed to live. That is because in the moments before the show, my laptop, which I am using since I am not in my normal studio, but all the way across the country, crashed. And for reasons that at least I'm going to share, they may not be justified, but for reasons that I'm going to share, I was uncomfortable without any prior preparation of just winging it on the program. You see, as I speak to you, there isn't a lot prepared, but there are things which are prepared and are tools which are helpful. I have my own homepage up, which is a not only has two clocks, so I know where we are in the program, which is helpful when you're doing a radio show. But in addition, the 10 largest news sources with their 10 leading headlines. So if something breaks that's important for us to discuss during the program, we can go immediately to it and be informed. I have the switchboard for this program, so know when you all call in and who it is and what you'd like to discuss. And then there are two Word documents that are always open. One of them is for the first hour of the show where we cover the news. The second turns to Yah's Torah and at least has notes, talking points, as well as excerpts of various things, all there to aid in a organized presentation of thoughts. When that all went away yesterday, I was willing to jump in on the second half of the program, but the news hour was a bit too much to bite off with nothing to work with. And I didn't want to just ramble on. So that's what happened yesterday. Should it happen again, I think I'm just going to jump in and hopefully encourage you all to call so that we can have a discussion on an item in the news. Today I want to begin the program. There's four stories I'd like to cover. We'll see how many of them we'll eventually get to. But the first is one that should provoke thinking. Many of you probably know that a young 14-year-old Pakistani girl was shot at point-blank range in the head by Taliban gunmen. Her name is Malala Yousafzai, or Yousafzai would be her last name. She is currently in critical condition. They say there's about a 70% chance she's going to live, but she has a bullet in her brain, another one near the nerve stem connecting her spine to her brain. And while it is tragic that a 14-year-old girl would be deliberately shot at point-blank range by religious gunmen, it is trying to understand the circumstances around this and what it actually means, understanding the motivations and consequences associated with this attempted assassination that are far more insightful. Well, the Taliban, who seek to impose a Sharia law throughout Pakistan and also throughout Afghanistan, they accused the young, we're going to call her an activist because that's what the media is calling her, of promoting secularism, and they say they will target her again for her anti-Taliban propaganda should she survive. You see, promoting secularism is considered a crime, one that should be punished by death in the minds of those poisoned by Islam. And while she was simply reporting on what it was like to be oppressed by these religious zealots, the truth is considered propaganda by those who would advocate the lie. And so it's not just a isolated death. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't the act of a singular, depraved lone wolf. This was a thoughtful and deliberate, purposeful assault by a very large religious organization on a little girl. She gained international attention, Malala did, when she was age 11, the article reads, this is from the BBC, when she started writing a diary for the BBC about life under the Taliban. Now, that happens to be a wee bit of a problem for her and the BBC's credibility. You see, the Taliban gained control over the Swat Valley in Pakistan in 2007. When this young girl was 9 years old. But they were ousted from Swat in 2009 when Malala was 11 and when she began writing her diary. So the diary reported to present life under the Taliban did not exist until the Taliban was gone. Nonetheless, we should know that the Taliban stopped this school bus just as it was leaving the children's school. On board, they asked each child for their name. They shot three of them. Malala in the head at point-blank range. Two other girls were injured, one of whom remained in a critical condition as of this morning. Now, schools in the Swat Valley closed on Wednesday in protest of the attack, and the school children in other parts of the country are shown praying for the girls' recovery. Imagine that. They're all dressed in Islamic head covers. They're all in the prescribed Islamic prayer position, hands in the appropriate position, everything as it would be appropriate for a Muslim to pray, and they're praying to the very God, wannabe God, and the very, as part of the very religion that oppressed and is oppressing little girls. Oh, yeah. Oh, Allah, I know that you're responsible for creating this despicable religion that treats women as if they were animals. And so I am praying to you as a wannabe God to help this little girl who spoke out in favor of us actually having a life. Oh, could you help her? I know that you oppose her, that you hate her, and that your followers murdered her, or tried to murder her, but maybe you could act out of character. I mean, come on. What on earth are they praying about? I mean, the very problem is the prayer. It's the God. It's the religion. Let's consider a few questions, none of which were asked by anyone in the media regarding this story. First, why was it necessary to speak in favor of educating girls? Isn't that a given? Shouldn't education for boys and girls, for men and women, be so ingrained as part of our culture that you would never have to speak about such a thing? Why was it necessary to speak in favor of educating girls? Why was it necessary to speak in favor of education? I mean, look at Yah's testimony on this. He named his testimony teaching. His primary encouragement to us is to be observant, to think about what you see, what you witness, so that you come to understand. Think about how upside down a culture has to be, how backwards, how inappropriate a culture has to be for it to be unique for a girl to speak about the merit of educating girls. And until you can come to the grips with why it was so unique that a little girl would speak in favor of educating girls. You're not in a position to understand how hideous Islam is or its consequence. Next question. Why was an advocate for girls and for education considered an enemy of the Taliban? Why didn't any media spokesperson, why didn't any politician jump on this and say, why was an advocate for education, why was an advocate for women considered an enemy of the Taliban? What is it that causes the Taliban to respond to education in this way? I mean, we have clues in Nigeria with Boko Haram, which means books, education is forbidden. What is the most lethal tool that can be wielded against a lie? The truth. The more people know, the more they understand, the harder it is for lies to prevail. The most effective tool that can be wielded against Islam is information, teaching. You want the single most effective tool? Teach people the Torah. Moreover, what is it about Islam that causes women to be treated so poorly? Is it not Muhammad, his lone prophet? The fact that he was a pedophile, a rapist, incestuous? Told us in his farewell sermon that women could be beaten, locked, naked in closets, starved to death, treated as if they were a domesticated animal for the consumption and pleasure of men? Is the problem not Islam? Why did the Taliban hunt down and shoot an unarmed child? That's the third question. Why was the Taliban's response, and they admitted they did this, and they said they'll do it again if she survives, why was the Taliban's response to criticism to murder in cold blood, try to murder a little girl? An unarmed girl. Why would they do that? What? How corrupt, how poisoned do you have to be for you to think that was not only a good idea, but that she should do it again if she survives? When we return to Shattering Myths, we'll discuss the example of Muhammad and how that drove this Islamic response and what it means to us as we move forward, as we consider why the media and our politicians didn't want you to know what I'm going to tell you. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You're encouraged to join us in this discussion at 877-300-7645. We were considering questions which no one in the media, no one from a religious pulpit, no one in politics bothered to ask about what happened in Pakistan when the Taliban knowingly, purposefully shot and attempted to murder a 14-year-old girl at point-blank range. Why did they do it? Why did they think that killing her was a valid expression of their religion? Well, the answer is really quite clear. The Quran claims to be Allah speaking to angel of Allah, speaking on behalf of Allah to Muhammad. And this angel conveniently says that everything that Muhammad wants, everything that Muhammad does, is appropriate. And that it tells Muslims how conveniently to follow Muhammad's orders, to follow Muhammad's example, to do whatever Muhammad tells them to do. So, what does Muhammad tell them to do? Well, there are three examples early in Islam where the poets of the day, who would be journalists today, was an illiterate society, so the only way to convey news was by mouth to ear. Written Arabic did not exist at the time that the Quran was allegedly revealed in perfect Arabic. And so poets were the orators of the day, and there were three incidents that are told by the companions of Muhammad in the Hadith and are recorded in all of the earliest sources. Same story about, in the case, it was one man and two women individually who spoke out against Muhammad. They said, he is lying to you. He is serving his own perverted desires. Allah is not God. The Quran is not scripture. This whole thing is a complete fraud, and by his own admission, he has been demon-possessed. Don't believe him, and most certainly, don't go off and kill for him, which is what the Muslims were doing. So these words, the evidence and reason that was presented by these poets was a threat to Muhammad and the creation of his new religion. So what did Muhammad do? He ordered his goons, the first Muslims, to murder each of these three individuals. And they all did so. They said first to Muhammad, you know, to sneak into these two women's homes and to the man's home, we're going to have to lie. We're going to have to deceive them. You know, is that okay with your God? Oh, absolutely. After all, Allah is the prince of lies. You can lie, Muhammad said. And then these men all carried out their deeds. We have in one case the man's head was brought back to Muhammad, and he was beheaded, as Muslims do today, following Muhammad's example, and thrown at Muhammad's feet and kicked around as if it were a soccer ball. And the two women, they were left in their beds to bleed to death. Both of them were nursing young children at the time they were murdered. And on one of the occasions, Muhammad's goons, his assassins, come back to him and say, hey, you know, Muhammad, this was, you know, more than we bargained for. You know, when we went into the bedroom of this woman, this poet, she had her children surrounding her in the bed. One was nursing, and right there with one nursing, we drove a knife into her heart. You know, we're feeling pretty guilty about this. And Muhammad said, no, you should not feel guilty about it. It is less important than two goats butting heads on a hill. And so it was Muhammad's response that the best way to deal with criticism was to kill the messenger. And so that is why the Taliban thought it was appropriate, religious, their duty to their God to attempt to murder this little girl. And so long as Islam exists, there will be Muslims willing to do the same thing. Next question, is there any value in opposing a symptom if you don't acknowledge the cause? This young girl, on behalf of the BBC, was exposing a symptom of Islam. The Taliban and their mistreatment of little girls and of women, their willingness to throw acid into the faces of little girls who dare go to school, their willingness to poison the waters of schools that educate little girls, their oppressive, fundamentalist religion, that this little girl, sponsored by the BBC, exposed the symptoms of fundamentalist Islam without ever once speaking out against the cause. Is that helpful or is that counterproductive? Let's consider the answer to that question when we return to Shattering Myths after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You're encouraged to join this conversation at 877-300-7645. We left with a question lingering. The question was quite simple. Is there any value in opposing a symptom if you don't acknowledge the cause? Let me give you another context. George W. Bush said that the Taliban, that Al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11. And he said that Al-Qaeda had a substantial presence in Iraq. And that we should therefore go and invade Iraq to eliminate this base for the Taliban. He said that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction and that the smoking gun was going to be the result of tons of yellowcake uranium that they had purchased from Nigeria. Very little of what he said was true. And yet America went to war on half-truths. Now, this president, Barack Obama, says that we're at war against the Taliban. Lashing out at a symptom. Is that helpful or is it counterproductive? Is a half-truth better than an outright lie? Or is a half-truth simply more beguiling? What good does it do to reveal the symptom if you don't expose and condemn the cause? If you're unwilling to address the cause, to acknowledge the cause, does lashing out at the symptom do any good? To complain that the Taliban don't want little girls to go to school, how is that useful if you don't expose and condemn the reason that the Taliban are opposed to education for little girls? So that you understand the cause of the problem. This article said what the Taliban want, and yet most people can't think it through. It says they want to impose Sharia law. What is Sharia law? It is a legal system that is based entirely on the life and words of Muhammad. Full stop. Sharia law is based entirely on the life and words of Muhammad. Period. End of conversation. So what was Muhammad like? What did he do and say? Well, during the first 10 years of the Islamic era, his most common pronouncement was demanding that the first Muslims terrorize everyone within camel ride of Medina, yesteryear's Yathrib. He ordered them to kill the men, to enslave and sell the children off as slaves, to rape the women. He led by example in this regard. He told his troops, the Mujahideen, the first jihadists, that it was good to lie. He said that his God lies. He said that any agreement that is made, any vow, any promise, any treaty that you make between yourselves and non-Muslims is not binding on you. He created a surah from his God that says that that it's lawful and good to steal. His Quran tells Muslims they are to fight against all humankind until the only religion and the only political system that exists on earth is Islam. That Allah alone is worshipped as God. So, this man, who was a pedophile, 53, he's having sex with a 9-year-old girl, repeatedly, who was a repeated rapist, who was incestuous, who was a sexual pervert, who was a kidnapper, who was a thief, who was an avowed liar, who was a mass murderer, who was sadistic, who claimed to be three times in his life to being demon-possessed and inspired by Satan. Sharia law is based entirely on his words and deeds. That's what the Taliban want. They are committed to the imposition of Sharia law. So I ask you, can there be any peace under Sharia? Can there be peace? Can there be civil society while Islam is accepted and tolerated? Can the world coexist with Islam? Will little girls be educated in a world if Muslims prevail? When we tolerate Islam, when we ignore Islam and instead focus on the behavior of those who adhere to the religion, we put ourselves in grave danger because we ignore the cause. That's like saying that we ought to be able to thwart an outbreak of smallpox by providing a salve which covers over the skin adhesions. Let's fight the symptom. Let's give people who have fever blankets and not treat and isolate the disease. That if we are all exposed to the disease that is Islam, no one else will catch it. What would life be like if you and I lived under the control of this religion in a country where this religion was the only lawful religion in the land, as it is throughout the Middle East? What would life be like? Even if you were a Muslim, what would it be like, especially if you were a woman? Can you imagine? What would the world be like if fundamentalist Muslims prevail? What is the consequence of us ignoring the cause and embracing, accepting Islam? Hello, Larry. It's good to hear from you this morning.
Good morning, Yada. You really struck a nerve with me there, really. I just had this debate yesterday on FB.
Yes.
I had two fellows jump in on a post. I mean, you know, a big part of what I do on FB is expose religion, any religion.
Yes. Yeah.
And political actors and media darlings for who they are.
Yeah.
And I had posted a picture of a woman who was buried, you know, with a little, sort of white shadow wrapped around her, and all you can really see is her face. She's grimacing, and she's buried, you know, up to her shoulders or thereabouts, so they can stone her to death.
Oh, wow.
And,
lovely.
And I had two gentlemen jump in. It's not the religion doing it. These are people doing it. And since these people are doing it
because of the religion.
This is not something that would be accepted in our backyard. I said, don't you get that? Further, you know, we've got the Pope yesterday, or day before yesterday, I can't remember now, going out and giving his first international prayer or speech in Arabic.
Okay. You see?
Yeah, and of course, this is after they've outlawed Yahweh's name. You know that. They've outlawed Yahweh's name.
Yeah, right.
But Allah is totally acceptable.
Of course.
Yeah,
they're going to say it's the same God. Pope will.
Well, it's probably the same God they worship, basically. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's
you know,
not
Christians,
Yahweh.
Christians throughout the Islamic world take copies of their Bible, and where it says the Lord...
They
put all in there.
Yeah, well, they could.
No, they do. I mean, you've got one stupid religion advocating another stupid religion.
Yeah, well, I think you call it the confused and the comatose, but in this case,
yes.
I say they're both comatose.
Yeah, I think that Christianity is a very effective, well-woven half-truth. It's a very beguiling lie. It has all of the earmarks of what Satan did to Chawa in the Garden of Eden. You know, it takes what God said out of context. It then misquotes him. Twist a word to create the opposite conclusion. And so it's a very effective counterfeit. It's easy to see why people can be confused by Islam by Christianity. I was for most of my life, and yet when you look at Islam, it's the religion of the comatose. You have to be stupid to be a Muslim. It is impossible to be a rational and thoughtful Muslim. I mean, it's absolutely impossible.
You asked the question to the audience. You asked the question to the audience. What would it be like for BNU if we lived in an Islamic society?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, I have the benefit of talking to Yalda, my wife.
Yes.
She can tell you. It's like living in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
You appropriately point out that, you know, there are plenty of good people that happen to be bad Muslims. But
yes.
Good Muslims are extremely bad people. And I think that, you know, she could paint you that picture. You know, they start telling them in first grade. In first grade. Now, I really want people to hear this. That should a man other than your husband ever see your hair, angels are going to hang you by your hair and begin beating you and beating you thousands of times. And, you know, I mean, she just went on to this rant. That, you know, telling first grade, it's like telling ghost stories to kids, you know, and telling them to go to sleep at night. You know, it's worse. And then you've got a situation where you
they didn't make that up. Muhammad, you know, he jumped on the wild flying ass, Al-Barak, and went from, on his mythical journey from, Mecca to, Jerusalem, that one night. And he then met in the non-existent temple, with all of the big shots of the, prophetic fame. And then, he used his wild ass to, jump up to heaven, and en route to heaven, he first went through hell. Which is kind of interesting that hell is en route to heaven, but there he tells us after leaving the hoofy print there in the dome of the rock, there he tells us that that when he went to hell he saw that all of its inhabitants were women, and he said that Allah was hanging these women by their breasts. He had meat hooks, and all of the women in hell were dangling there on meat hooks by the breast. That was his explanation of what he saw. And so Muhammad was asked, you know, why were they here? And he said, because they didn't show the proper respect to their husbands. That is why they were there. And then he goes on to say, you know, but you're questioning even our ability to question you. And he says that's because Allah says that your testimony is only worth half of a man's, and therefore your value is half of a man's.
Well, they have half a brain, too. Half a brain.
Yeah. We'll return to Shattering Mist after a moment. Stay with us, Larry. To Shattering This, I'm your host Yada. We're here with Larry. Larry, I want to turn the page a bit because Islam is not the only stupid religion. It just might be the most overtly satanic, but that does not mean that it alone is responsible for bad behavior. This is a Dateline Lagos, Nigeria. The story comes to us by way of CNN. Investigators in Nigeria said that they have taken 13 people into custody after a mob attacked four students and burned them alive. Killings that were videotaped and posted online. You are a significant user of Facebook, Larry. I don't know if you saw this story or if you went to YouTube to watch the video.
I can't see the story. I did see the story. Yeah,
I watched.
I was in a hard picture and I read the story.
Yeah. I read the, I mean, I witnessed the video. In fact, I would encourage everyone to. It's kind of like the beheadings that took place throughout Iraq and Afghanistan when the most fundamentalist Muslims kidnapped and captured somebody. They would film themselves reciting Quran verses while sawing off the person's head as they screamed for help. This is every bit that gruesome, and when you see people perpetrate in large crowds such gruesome acts, it's really important to witness them. As gruesome as they are, as horrific as it is, because you need to understand what drives people in groups to do such behavior. If you don't understand group mentality and how culture influences group mentality, the consequence is grievous for you, because this is the very thing that you will see in these videos is what ultimately is going to sweep across Europe and the United States. Anyway, the gruesome video on YouTube presents several men on the dirt, withering in pain. They are bloodied. They have had tires shoved over their necks. You can see them being constantly beaten with large sticks, you know, 4-inch diameter sticks wielded over the heads of the perpetrator and beating down on these men as they lie there naked, realizing there's nothing they can do to get away. And large crowds around them. The video shows the four men beaten by this mob with these wooden sticks before being set on fire, and they're literally being burned alive. Now, the students were accused of stealing laptops and mobile phones. So your first inclination is, all right, I've seen this before. This is what happened in the streets of Fallujah with the Americans being burned alive. This is Muslims perpetrating hell on non-Muslims. But don't be so quick. It wasn't Muslims. This was in the south, the most southern part of Nigeria. These were Christians perpetrating this hell on others. One of the classmates told the BBC that the four had left the university campus in search of collecting money that they were owed, and they were mistaken as thieves. But others say that that isn't the case. They were actually cult members, and they were hunted down and killed to discourage people from joining such cults. So, a second article that I found on it says it appears the police will need the wisdom of Solomon to crack down this case of four Nigerian students who were, this one says, lynched early Friday. They weren't lynched. They were burned alive after being beaten by the community, all of which was surrounding them for allegedly stealing handsets and laptops. This is because there are various theories that are now being circulated regarding why Chayed E. Kobe, Tekkina, and Ugana, and Iliad in the Alu community of Port Harcourt in Nigeria's southern state were tormented in this way. Contrary to the earlier claim that they had stolen handsets and laptops, another version was peddled by some people who claimed to be eyewitnesses. That is, that these youths in their early 20s, and they were very wealthy Nigerians, they were meticulously dressed before they were treated this way. They came from wealthy families. They had their own Facebook pages. That they were in their early 20s and they were cultists who were nabbed by the community's vigilante group while on a robbery mission. It says the students were involved in cults. There were five in number. One of them got away. And they were found when they sought out a girl. She screamed, alerted people, and they were therefore caught. Now, we're going to return and cover just a little bit of this story, Larry, at the top of the hour before we turn our attention to a letter and try to resolve the myths of Christianity. But it is important to know what it means to be part of a cult and why people in a religious society respond in this way. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Hi, this is Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. They're disturbing health facts in the United States. We are now 60th in life expectancy, 41st in infant mortality. Autism is up from 1.